Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. I'm Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Donna is back in the kitchen this week. She says...
No. I wasn't out of the kitchen. I was just out of my kitchen.
Oh, Donna was out of her kitchen.
In Ames. I was out of Ames.
And also out of this Donna Lana kitchen. She was not here at all for a while. We missed her greatly. She's got many...
And I missed you, too.
Oh, thank you.
I'm really happy to be home.
Oh, good. I hope you have many tales to tell of your trip to California. This is St. Patrick's Day. We will explore some food from the Emerald Isle, and we'll also consider the Green Revolution and a recent lecture by Vandana Shiva on the ISU campus this past week. That lecture was entitled, The Future of Food. This show is supported by Wheatsfield Co-op.
Support from the Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocer in Ames, community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop at Wheatsfield Co-op.
Good. As I mentioned, this is St. Patrick's Day. Our thoughts are turning to green a little bit here. If you look really, really close, there's a little bit of green coming up in your yard. Kick over some brown leaves.
And I'm a little worried about those things. Now, when we get another freeze, what's going to happen to them?
Spoken like a true Iowan.
My little rhubarbies are coming up. And how's the lovage? Have you seen the lovage?
Mine isn't up yet. But then I'm north of Ames, you see, and you live in Ames. So
I'll go poke around where it's supposed to be. But
don't worry. The things that are coming up right now tend to be the really hardy ones that are growing back from long-lived roots or a long-lived bulb underneath the ground or corm, like irises and things. And
the daffodils are poking up.
They're poking. And really, even if they get a little nip, it's all right.
Let's hope it's only little nips.
For the rest of us, too. For the rest of us, yeah. Anyway, the robins are back. They've been arriving by the busload, I think. Just robins all over the place, all of a sudden, and it's such a joy. The sounds outside of your back door all of a sudden are different. It's no longer the cold, cold noises of birds shivering. They're actually tweeting and talking to each other out there. The owls in my woods around my house are busy with their hooting, which is good. They've been quiet for a while.
What kind of owls?
I believe I have barred owls around here. They're really big.
Mm-hmm,
they're really big.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones. Now, I only know this because Jim Pease, the local wildlife specialist person around here, told me that barred owls make the noise that goes, who cooks for you? Who cooks for you?
And
that's it. That's it.
Ha-ha.
See,
okay.
I know that now. And I thought I was the only one that put words to owls, but Jim does that too. So I was much relieved that that's actually a handle that
you and I ought to be able to remember.
Oh, right. Very good.
Yes. Oh, we've got a theme going on here,
so,
Alana.
On some of these spring nights, it sounds like the forest primeval out there. It's kind of nice.
Looks like the forest primeval still, doesn't it?
It does. It does. So we hope for more green. And I'd like to share with you another lovely sign of spring. Out my kitchen window, I've been watching my bird feeder, and I haven't seen one in ages, but I have a bird sighting. I saw a tufted titmouse, and I am just thrilled. Now,
I wouldn't know one if it bit me. What do they look like?
Oh, I will tell you. Also, here's a little warning to any FCC regulators out there. This is a tufted titmouse, and the syllable T-I-T is firmly affixed to the second syllable, M-O-U-S-E. That's titmouse. That's one word. That is a bird. A tufted titmouse is common and widespread in mature, deciduous woods. It's a very small bird, actually. It has a crest on its head.
Oh, okay. So
like a
Like a miniature cardinal.
Like a miniature cardinal, but it's very miniature. And it's gray on the back, and it's white underneath, and it's got white around its eyes, little black button eyes, these wonderful things. And it has a little bit of orange underneath its wings.
Oh!
It feeds on insects and seeds. It's larger than chickadees, but quite smaller than a cardinal.
Does that put it like in the sparrow range
or
something?
Yeah, right. And it's a very upright little bird, that little pointy thing on top of his head kind of makes him look like a...
Okay, so the tuft would be the identifying...
Right. And it's very gray, mm-hmm. very pretty. It's larger than chickadees and relatively short-tailed with small pointed crest. It's pale gray overall with orange flanks. And I noticed it because it had an amazing voice. The little tune that it sang was quite nice. So,
is it like in the thrush family or something?
Oh, good heavens, I don't know.
Well, when you say it's singing, that's immediately
I don't know.
We get a lot of those little songsters in the in the yard.
Anyway, welcome to the area, Tufted Titmouse.
Yes, welcome to the almost spring. Here we go.
So, Donna, where have you been these past weeks?
I went to California, to Southern California, and when I left, it was 7 degrees. So I was actually really happy to go, however briefly. And I was cooking at an event that I have done often, mostly for 17 years. So it's for an organization, a nonprofit agricultural organization called Organic Farming Research Foundation. And the event we have, it's a fundraiser for them, is at something called the Natural Products Expo, which is always in Anaheim in Southern California. And it's the biggest big food show, natural products. So, everything organic, everything natural, any product that you would find either at Wheatsfield or in the grocery aisles like at Hy-Vee that are designated as a natural department, all of those products are there. It's enormous. Apparently this year 71,000 people attended and there were 2,700 overwhelming booths. So that's a lot of product to look at.
You certainly couldn't have seen it all.
No, I didn't. As a matter of fact, I hardly saw any of it because I was in the kitchen cooking for the event itself was 300 people, and we bring into this huge conventional Airmark kitchen, which the kitchen itself is the size of a football field. So we bring in all organic product ourselves because we wanted the food to be all organic and make from scratch everything. So it's a delightful buffet, but it took 3 days of like 12 to 14 hours of cooking.
How many people were helping you?
Oh, well, let's see. There were three chefs, myself included, and then we had a whole cadre of peelers and choppers and, five plus just going at it full time. And it's a marathon. Make sure I still have my chops together, as it were, professionally. And it's a lot of fun, although quite exhausting. But I have to say, I kept up with everyone.
Well, good for you.
And we'd of course spent months planning it and getting all the right foods in at the right time. So it really was a lot of fun. And we had it outside in a tented venue, and it was a beautiful day, and everybody loved it. And then the next day, everybody goes out onto the convention floor to either man their booths or, go around tasting and sampling. So you get thousands of bites of, this protein bar and that cup of coffee and twiddle-dum tea and, so you go around eating all these bites till your stomach is going, what happened to me?
Even if all this stuff is organic and supposed to be good for you.
Oh, yeah, but you can't.
2,000 booths are kind of overdo it.
You can't put that much stuff into you and not go, oh, no, this is overwhelming. So having this pre-dinner, which we had, I think, 12 or 14 different kind of items on the menu, and it was really, we did one thing that was really fun. We had, the tables were set with, the usual centerpieces, and then we put a dessert at each place setting that consisted of kind of a small glass. I think it held about 3 ounces, rather like a small yogurt container, but it was a glass, and we filled it up with this delicious chocolate cardamom pudding, right? So, and then on top of it, we took some Newman's Own I think they were chocolate animal crackers, and we crushed them up until they looked like fine dirt. So then we put that on top of the chocolate pudding, and then we stuck a mint sprig in it. So it looked like a plant on the table. In fact, we even saw one super executive trying to pour water into it as the melt, as the mint was kind of starting to wilt. He thought it was a plant.
You did a good job.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. It was delicious. And it kind of fit in with the theme of farming and agriculture. And Organic Farming Research Foundation is an organization that long ago started the Organic Caucus in Congress and has brought a lot of attention and lobbying efforts to, you know, the needs to have more sustainable research within the USDA, and it's I'm quite proud to be supporting it.
Oh, a wonderful, wonderful experience. So all of these new products, all of these food people, what is, as they say, what is trending?
Oh, yes. Well, that is the place for trend spotting. I mean, you talk about, it's a very large convention center. So we're talking, it's three floors of maybe 10 football fields. I mean, it's unbelievable. I don't even try to go through all of it. I kind of stick in the organic section, and plus I'm usually totally exhausted by the time the show starts. So, but there were a few things that I saw that were really interesting. One is everybody's into protein, specifically dairy protein. Like for example, Organic Valley has this new campaign. It goes something like save a brother. Now, a brother is somebody who's like a muscle man body workout person. And, you know, people who are bodybuilders always are eating a lot of protein products, powders and bars and this and that. And a lot of those, and these are usually very healthy people, right?
Or they try to be.
Yes, exactly. But a lot of the products that they're eating, in fact, if you read the ingredients, are a little bit dicey. So Organic Valley is a company that they have now made an organic, healthy protein drink specifically for bodybuilders. So the joke is save a bro. It's kind of like save them from themselves, you know, these workout guys. But there were also a lot of other companies doing different protein individual packets of things, you know, more little of those dehydrated meat bar kind of things like Tonka bars that you can buy at Wheatsfield or lots of little packages of different kinds of, like even cottage cheeses, the new sexy cottage cheese, you know, with blueberries and acai in a container the size of a yogurt portion, or some new quark cheeses, which is also a very concentrated dairy protein. Of course, a million different fortified yogurts, you know, but these things all in little convenient package. Or there was one called a slingshot, which is it's a two-part package where it has the yogurty or liquid dairy ingredient in one part of the package, and the other part has the grainy chia seed, you know, fiber, da 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 da. And when you eat them, you open one part of the package and you put the, I guess that's the sling, into the shot. So you mix them just when you want to eat them, so they're not mushy.
Well, they've been packaging super glue like that for years.
Exactly.
So now we have it.
It's all grab and go, convenient for our fast, crazy lifestyles where you still want to be healthy.
Right. Well, it sounds like people have a lot of fun doing this. Of course, this is big business.
Oh, big, big, big business. The natural products industry is maybe up to 20 years is the only part of, like, conventional food industry is kind of, as they would say, flatlined in terms of profits, whereas organic and natural has been growing at a rapid clip somewhere. Well, probably averages around 10% per year. Some years, I mean, after 2008, it kind of went down to maybe 8%, but there were times it was like 20%. So everybody and their brother with a business brain is trying to move into this industry. I did visit one booth of a company that I'm very fond of that we do have available here in Iowa, and it's called Lotus Foods. And they were kind of the first to import certain traditional rices from China. So like black rice, which is called it's called forbidden rice because it was originally only for the emperor. And so you can buy it as a rice. And I love to cook with it because it's very beautiful. And they also have some kind of red rice and several of their rices. And now they have a new a ramen package, which we can eat here in Ames. But the thing that I didn't realize about this is that the research shows that these colored rices are packed with antioxidants. Seems that it has more antioxidants than blueberries and broccoli.
Now, this is not antioxidants added. This is how these rice
I had read this
grow.
About corn a long time ago. The darker Indian corns, for example, also have the when you see these colors like blueberry color, black rice, Indian corn, which could be red, can be black, that more of this color in the food, whether it's a fruit or a grain, the higher the antioxidant levels are.
Well,
so we could just be eating black rice ramen.
Well, that sounds good.
These are
all native varieties to Asia. I mean, they've been growing for...
Dr. Oz calls black rice, quote, a number one fatigue fighter and, quote, his health secret, for example. That was in the brochure. It's actually, it's yummy. It's beautiful. It's just a switch out from rice, particularly white rice would be a huge improvement over white rice. These are whole grains. And they also have a red rice that I think is probably quite – it's called pigmented rice.
It is not pigment added. This is
This is natural. Just like, you know, we have different colors of corn, mm-hmm. we have different colors of rice.
And who's to know – who would have thought that? Well, of course we knew that. Everybody knew that at one time. We were thinking about rice actually last week. We were thinking about the Green Revolution last week. Vandana Shiva was here in town,
and she talked about rice.
Boy,
was she amazing.
Oh, wasn't she just great? She talked about rice, too. The idea that all of these grains that are naturally high in nutrients, they're all available.
And have been for centuries. And are non-patented.
Right. So we get into some really interesting topics here. Both Donna and I had the pleasure of going to the Vandana Shiva lecture last week, along with about 700 others. It was a really well-attended lecture.
It was a very nice turnout, and she's a great speaker. She's kind, she's humorous, and it was could have been very confrontational because her message is not what we're used to hearing here from ISU.
Also, her message was not what we're used to hearing, as I might call it, here in the belly of the beast.
Yes.
When we're dealing with really big ag, corporate ag, GMOs, there is another way to look at things.
You know, my basic takeaway in her upshot, she started right off with this, mm-hmm. was saying, you know, it wasn't about whether or not GMOs are good or bad for you or this or that or anything controversial. It was point blank the economics of it, because Vandana Shiva is an advocate for traditional seeds, and traditional in the sense that if you grow that corn, you can plant it again yourself next year, which is not something you can do with a genetically modified because it has been patented.
Mm-hmm.
So her basic message was, farmers, why are you paying this company a certain percentage more, and it's not insignificant how expensive those seeds are, for something that, you know, for centuries you could save and grow yourself? What advantage are you really, really gaining? You're using the same amounts of pesticides. There's so many cost similarities, except for you're paying more for seed. Why?
Right. She had a wonderful way of looking at things. We talk about bioengineering and bioscience and biomass and all that kind of stuff. And we have to realize that science always has consequences. And so she talked about bioimperialism and biodemocracy. Do we do it imperialistically or do we do it democratically? And that brought up a whole lot of interesting things in her lecture, and was really definitely worth listening to. I got one of her books, and I had a wonderful time reading it.
Oh, and don't we have the link to where that can be listened to?
Right.
It was less than an hour, right, wasn't it?
Yes, let's see.
So you
– Oh, yes, you can go to the ISU Lectures website and download that lecture. I don't have the
– Vandana Shiva.
Vandana Shiva, yes.
Yeah. It's definitely worth a listen, particularly even though she's – you know, you can read her books and all this. This was so specifically important for Iowa audiences, a rare tailor-made message that I think was very helpful.
Yeah, we had the good fortune of a brief meeting with Vandana Shiva. Very brief, but it was very fruitful. She was gracious enough to leave us with a short message for us here in Iowa.
You are listening to KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, community radio for the heart of Iowa. I'm Dr. Vandana Shiva. I would love to see Iowa become a land of diversity, fertile soils, and small, hardworking, proud farmers once again.
She was wonderful.
Isn't she sweet?
Yes.
That's the vision that I think many of us hold. It's kind of what Iowa used to be, and we'd like to retain that.
And we can do that, and it has a whole lot to do with how we feed ourselves and how we take care of our planet in the future. I'm going to read a little bit. I have a few sentences here from her book. I picked up the Vandana Shiva Reader. There's other books, too.
She has lots of books.
Yeah. This one has a foreword by Wendell Berry, and Wendell Berry starts out saying that he's so glad he's a friend of Vandana Shiva because he sure didn't want to be her enemy. She's very well-spoken, yes. Anyway, in the lecture, the topic of the Green Revolution came up again. And again, it was trying the bio-imperialistic way, or the we-can-tell-you-what's-good-for-you way of feeding the world. And it's kind of nice to see how that's been working. Here's what Vandana Shiva says about that. The strategy of the Green Revolution was aimed at transcending scarcity and creating abundance. Yet it put new demands on scarce renewable resources and generated new demands for non-renewable resources. The Green Revolution technology required heavy investments in fertilizer, pesticides, seed, water, and energy. Intensive agriculture generated severe ecological destruction, created new kinds of scarcity and vulnerability, and resulted in new levels of inefficiency and resource use. Instead of transcending the limits imposed by natural endowments of land and water, the Green Revolution introduced a new constraints on agriculture by wasting and destroying land, water resources, and crop diversity. And she has a quote here from another person named Angus Wright.
Well, I know Angus. He's lovely. He's a Southern California environmental professor, and his specialty is the Brazilian Campesinos.
Ah, here's a great quote by him. One way in which agricultural research went wrong was precisely in saying and allowing it to be said that some miracle was being produced. Historically, science and technology made their first advances by rejecting the idea of miracles in the natural world. Perhaps it would be best to return to that position.
I can't remember where I read it, but I read it last week. There's some, like, not practical farmers of Iowa, nobody that we, you know, runs in our sort of left-leaning circles, but a very normal Iowa farmer, the kind with 2,500 acres, who 3 years ago started planting a little non-GMO seed, like maybe 350 acres. And he found that he saved money on the seeds by about 50%, and then all of his other costs were exactly the same. So the next year, he planted more acres and more acres and more acres until he's actually growing completely non-GMO seed, getting slightly better yields, using the same input costs and saving about 50% on his seed cost. Now that is a pragmatic approach.
There you go.
You don't need those GMOs, do you?
Another thing that was talked about was trusting the farmer, trusting your own common sense to do the field tests and to see what's going on and do your own research. Yeah, how about that? Yeah, we're talking revolution here, folks. We are. Also, you can find out more about this past lecture because right here on KHOI, Local Talk interviewed some people that responded to Vandana Shiva's talk, and you can stream. Go to the KHOI website, khoifm.org. Go to local talk, and you can stream that interview. Co-hosts Gail Seeler and Greta Anderson talk to Angie Carter and Dr. Clark Wolf. And they've all had things to say about that lecture. Oh, also they talked to Dr. Michael Owen from ISU. So that's an interesting take on food, on food sovereignty, on things going on.
Very relevant to Iowa.
Very relevant. We'll take a little music break here. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Happy St. Patrick's Day. That was an Irish band from Chicago named Bohola, B-O-H-O-L-A. One of my favorites. These guys are great. Three guys, Jimmy Keane on accordion, and I happened to see them perform. There's this big man with the biggest accordion I've ever seen sitting on a chair with his foot hitting on a rhythm box on his feet, and he could just play for ages. We'll hear some more of their music later. There's also Sean Cleland on fiddle and Pat Broders that plays bouzouki and sings beautifully. So we'll hear a little bit more of their music later. We've got some thoughts on St. Patrick's Day and food from the Emerald Isle. Donna brought in an Irish cookbook and has been having a lot of fun talking about Irish food.
Dorina Allen runs something called the Ballymaloe Cooking School. And she is, I would say she's Ireland's Alice Waters. If you don't know who Alice Waters is, that doesn't mean anything. But what she has done is revive the traditional Irish ways. The cooking school is on an old family farm, so it's kind of plopped down right in the middle of most of its provenance, basically. You know, they try to cook from their own garden, and, you know, it's kind of like our farm-to-fork thing. She's been doing this, though, probably at least 20 years. I met her actually in Italy at a Slow Foods event, and she's a lovely red-haired lady. This particular book is called Irish Traditional Cooking, and if you want to delve into your Irish roots and are feeling particularly Irish other than on just St. Patrick's Day, I would really, really recommend it. The subtitle is Over 300 Recipes from Ireland's Heritage. She goes around, even in the course, when I'm checking out a cookbook, the first thing I go is to the dessert section. And just, you know, that's kind of like, okay, let's see how creative they really are. And it's really, she not only has a dessert section, she also has something. Pancakes are not just the pancakes. They use all kinds of different flours, oatmeals, and other grains, cakes and biscuits. Then she gets into the Irish pantry, which includes all kinds of, you know, old-style things. And there are a lot of recipes where she has, here's something in the Irish pantry. Protestant lemonade. And then, of course, dandelion coffee, ginger beer, raspberry vinegar, cowslip vinegar, haymaking drink. Oh, of course, old-fashioned marmalade. We would expect that. Rhubarb and figgy jam. And cakes. She's got the Gur cake, the Tipsy cake, the Wakes cake, funeral buns, queen cakes and other dainties, cake dances. It's just delightful. And she, to put this book together, she actually kind of solicited a lot of older women that were still doing traditional baking, like some even who were, she went and learned how to actually cook everything over an open fire in a traditional hearth. And she writes about this in here. And wonderful stories. She talks about the women she gets this stuff from and, you know, credits them. And the pictures are just beautiful. It's a very inspiring book. So if you're feeling Irish, this would be the purchase to make and
or if you're feeling hungry, the pictures in here are really pretty.
Oh, yeah. It's country cooking, and a lot of the stuff that is relevant in to their kind of cooking and what's available to them is very available in Iowa. Not exactly the same climate, but close enough. A particular thing that I found in here that I was talking to Lana, this goes on to our backyard chicken theme. She talked about buttered eggs. She says, one of the most exciting things I have discovered while working on this book is buttered eggs. Now, I'm thinking, okay, fried eggs
butter.
Or something like the traditional way of preserving eggs for the short term is likely to have originated in the 19th century. At this time, Ireland was exporting an astonishing number of eggs to Britain, where there was a great demand for eggs. For example, in 1850, Ireland exported 11 million eggs annually, and this figure rose to 40 million by 1900. Okay, now she's going to explain what the practice is, and I'm hoping Lana will do it so we can fool around here. This practice deserves to be more widely known for the wonderful flavor and texture it produces. My favorite thing, right back to flavor, any way to get more flavor. So anyone who has their own hens can try it, Lana. The critical thing is that the eggs must be collected from the nest as soon as they are laid. So you're going to stand there and watch your hens, I guess.
I have done that. It's an experience, I tell you.
So you catch them while they're still warm, and then the shells are rubbed with a thin layer of butter, she says, while they're still warm.
Really?
This seals in the freshness, so the albumen stays soft and curdy when boiled or poached. Buttered eggs are a great specialty in Cork, where they're still sold in the Old English Market in Cork City. So I'm hoping that you'll make a few of these for me so we can try them. It's a preservation technique.
This sounds really interesting. Who would have thought? There
well, obviously the Irish. I mean, we don't think about eggshells being porous, but they are.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
The butter is to seal, you know, makes kind of a, keeps the air from going in, puts a thin oil film around. I mean, I suppose you could rub them in olive oil, too.
Right.
But butter sounds really wonderful.
Or Vaseline. Oh, no. No. Butter sounds much better. Yes.
Butter is better, right?
Oh, good. So that's buttered eggs from Ireland.
That's buttered eggs. I know. So I hope we can do that. Because then I want to cook up a few and see how they really are different.
Let's give it a try.
Yeah.
Good idea. So I'll have to talk to the girls and see what we can come up with. They're good girls. We'll get you some eggs, and we'll have a report on a future show.
That's Dorina Allen, and it's called The Irish Traditional Cooking, Over 300 Recipes from Ireland's Heritage. There are other Dorena Allen cookbooks, of all of which are delightful. It's on my bucket list to go to the Ballymaloe cooking school sometime. So, and here's another thing about St. Patrick's Day that we all need to know. It's the thing about corned beef and cabbage. It's not really a St. Patrick's Day dish. Yes, there's an Irish tie-in, but what we think of as corned beef is totally American. Did you know that? And it's a delightful cultural mashup. So this is the massively oversimplified Reader's Digest version of how the dish came to be. Salted pork, think bacon, was popular in Ireland in the 18th and 19th centuries. When the Irish immigrants began arriving in New York in the 1840s, that pork was replaced by cured brisket from the kosher butchers.
Of course, kosher butchers would not have pork.
No, a more affordable cut that still tasted like the old country. Slowly cooked with cheap vegetables like potatoes and cabbage, a new national dish was born. For the Irish Americans, that is. So when you're having your beef brisket, don't be feeling so Irish. Be feeling American Irish.
Uh-huh.
That is what this is all about, after all.
Huh. Oh, here, I found this too. The Brits invented the term corned beef in the 17th century to describe the corn-sized kernels of crystallized salt that was used to cure the meat.
Oh!
So it had lumps of... I was wondering about that. I wondered why corn. Why corn?
Corn,
yeah. It was...
Salt-cured.
Yeah, salt-cured. Yeah. And they highly suggested using a concentrated pink curing salt. And that's why the really
pink
good corned beef.
Pink curing salt. I wonder if that's like the... The pink salts that you see now.
Well, probably that you can get some, you can get pink looking salt.
Oh, yeah. And salt, of course, was one of the first globally traded items.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So who knows?
Yeah. Corned beef is a lovely thing. It goes well with, you often think of cabbage and actually cold cannon, putting kale or some cabbage in with your potatoes and having that. That's a real Irishy sort of thing.
Well, wait, I want you also to mention, and this is not Irish particularly, what did you cook for dinner last night, Lana?
Oh, what did I cook for dinner? I had a squirrel. People look at me funny. I know I had a squirrel, and I remembered how to skin it when my husband brought me this squirrel, and it was good, too. Although, and I found out from talking to my neighbor that hunts, I was wondering why it was so hard to skin. I don't remember him being so hard to skin, but he said that in the...
Is this an old squirrel?
No, not old. time of the year, end of a hard winter.
Their fur is sticking to their skin.
Well, yeah, not as much fat or whatever.
Oh.
I don't know. But anyway, the idea of skinning a squirrel, actually, I think you do this for rabbits, too. And if you have a queasy stomach, don't listen to this part. But you take the little squirrel guy, and it helps a whole lot if... There's another person with another pair of hands because you use a sharp knife and cut around where its belt buckle would be and you work your fingers in there and you pull.
On the back or the belly side?
All the way around. Make a complete
uh-huh.
circle
uh-huh.
all the way around. And one person takes off the shirt. The other person takes off the pants. And you pull,
uh-huh.
pull. And it's rather inelegant, but that's with two people doing it, it's a really easy way. And then you can gut it after that.
Well, I need to learn because in my family, the skinning part was always done by the men. And though my son can skin and my father certainly could skin, I have been left out of this. And since I have neither of them around, that would make me helpless. I better learn to skin.
Well, one should learn these sort of things. And it's not like I was ever... jumping into it a lot. It's just that if I was handy, it was, get over here, Lana. Lend me your hand and we'll do
pull,
this together.
Yeah,
pull.
My mother always used to say, this old saying, there's more than one way to skin a cat.
Maybe that's it. Oh, dear.
Well, I suppose there's different methodologies for where to start. I mean, we could
say
there's more than one way to skin a squirrel, but...
Probably. But that's how I learned. Once you get that going and undress the little fella, and actually,
did your mother used to say that? Is that an old saying in your family too? There's more than one way to skin a cat.
No, my mom didn't like cats.
Oh, well, even more reason to skin them. No, but, I mean, Mother used to always say that as a way of saying, you know, there are several ways to do this thing, you know. That means there's more than one way to skin a cat.
I like that term a lot, actually. So, today is March 17th, and it is the National Day of Ireland, and it's the feast for the triple bearer of the triple key, the trident-bearing Celtic divinity assimilated into St. Patrick, whose sacred plant is the shamrock.
Okay, so we're talking about the pagan origins.
Yep, the pagan origins.
And with the Catholic overlay of St. Patrick.
Right. There was a Celtic divinity that had a shamrock. And
pre-Christian.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And yesterday was a day to honor Dionysus, so grab yourself some wine. And on March 15th, remember, the Ides of March, that date was famous for the day on which Julius Caesar was assassinated.
Beware the Ides of March.
It's also the holy day of the Greek goddess Rhea, R-H-E-A, and it's traditionally a time to honor rivers, river sprites and nymphs. So this time of year, spring is
coming up. On the equinox, which is always a major, you know, we've started into the Lenten fasting and all the pre-fertility approaching of spring and rabbits and eggs and birds and oh my.
It's been a long winter and we're glad to see them come. Back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was some Irish music by the band Bohola. You were listening to the Redican Jig and the Merry Old Woman Jig. There you go. Support KHOI. This is KHOI FM 89.1, Story City, Ames. Support this station. We are a community radio station. We are volunteers that do this. Donna and I get together for the Donalana Kitchen every Tuesday at noon. We do this live. You can also hear this same program 7 o'clock in the evening on Tuesdays. And you can go to khoifm.org and
hear it anytime you like.
Hear it anytime you like.
At your convenience.
Yes, do that. And you can go to the Donalana Kitchen webpage and find way too many shows. You just don't know where to start looking there. Plus, we have some recipes posted there. So
right, also, we have a whole year, long year of shows under our belt now.
Kind of scary. That's good.
We're also another year older, Lana.
Oh, dear.
And deeper in debt.
I knew that was coming.
As the saying goes, yes.
I knew that was coming. So support this radio station by listening, by donating, by coming down and being part of our volunteer organization down here. We could use all kinds of people with all kinds of talents. And if you don't like what you hear on the radio, come on down and
make your own show.
You can do that. You can do that.
So let's get back to this extraordinary weather. It's turning everyone to thoughts of gardens. And as I put out my outside chair on the back porch,
it's
so I can
spring.
Have my coffee out there, but I'm looking at total desolation, and I'm going, oh, how am I going to get those Mexican sunflowers over there, and where should I? Okay, so my downfall as a gardener, the chief downfall, is I am not a good seed starter. So Lana is a very good seed starter.
Oh, after many years of trying different things.
I think I'm a little heavy-handed, but tell me.
The absolute miracle of the fact that seeds produce plants, we totally ignore that effect so often. They're just magic little things that go in the ground. Each seed is a potential life force. So a good thing to remember about seeds.
Unless it's a GMO seed.
Oh, right.
Recreate itself without a huge financial investment. So
Right. Oh, also there's hybrid seeds, but that's different. At least the hybrid seed will germinate, so that's fine. But all of this important, very valuable and very dynamic stuff can be seen with seed starting. Starting seeds inside works really well for some things. I'm starting peppers and tomatoes right now. Information on starting seeds you can usually find in a seed catalog, a good seed catalog, or look it up online. Each seed, or read it on the seed packet. It tells you, does this seed need to be deep underground, totally covered? Does it need to be on the surface because it needs light? Some seeds need light to germinate. So how deep you plant it.
What do you need, a good southern window then?
Yeah, you do, because this time of year, we don't get a lot of light happening. Well, we do now, but it's coming. So, yes, a good southern window. One trick about that is that you can also dry seeds out. If you are planting seeds in a small plastic container or in a yogurt cup or in a flat and you put it really close to a window and the sun does shine, that's great.
Too much evaporation.
But you can dry things
out. So what's the trick for keeping them evenly moist, even temperature? I mean, this is where I'm an utter failure.
Well, two things.
They're so delicate.
Two things that I find is that realize that these are living things, and you kind of it's like you have adopted a puppy for a month or so while they're growing. You can't just put them there and forget it. You have to, like, look at it once or twice a day, morning, afternoon, something like that.
Twice a day, okay.
At least. Oh, yeah. Visit them often. And keep them watered. Here's a trick I use before the seeds emerge. You can cover your flats with either wax paper or saran wrap or something.
Huh.
Or put them in a plastic bag, not totally covered. You want a little air in there. You don't want it to start getting too soggy in there.
So you got a moisture retaining barrier.
Yeah. So make a little blanket. Make a little blanket. So there you go. That helps. That helps a lot with especially that first week where the seeds aren't going to do anything and you just know that nothing is going to happen. So keep them covered with a loose sheet of wax paper.
How do you keep them hydrated once they're too big for that?
Water them a lot.
Like twice a day, you mean?
Yeah. Look at them twice a day.
Uh-huh.
Once they're kind of up and running, once there's green on top, they're a little tougher, and they can stand a little bit of a drying out. But that helps to keep them moist, at least for that first that first germination period. And again, things that you can learn from your seed packets and things that you can learn from looking up each variety online or from books on seed starting is how long a seed takes to germinate. Some take, some come up really fast, 3-4 days. Others, 14 days. Others, you know, 20 days. There's some seeds that you have to scarify, which means you have to scratch the surface. Heaven knows why that's a why that's been part of their genetic makeup, but it will tell you those things, and it really does make a difference. So read what it says on the seed packet, and keep things watered. Keep things
and
moist.
How do you keep them? This is another problem I always have: is they get really leggy, too long and spindly and not strong enough, and then they kind of die.
Yeah, that's why, especially if you're doing it in a kitchen window, don't start your seeds too early because they're trying.
Could be my problem. Right. I'm always ahead of my game.
Right, right.
Impatient.
again, read on the seed packet or the information you get the seeds, how long to transplant. If it needs 6 weeks before you transplant or 4 weeks before you have a transplantable.
Okay, so now is the time to start peppers and
tomatoes. And I've things like kale. I started.
How about my radicchio? Are you doing my radicchio?
I got radicchio in some pots.
Oh, hallelujah. I'm really looking forward to radicchio this summer.
Interesting greens you can put in early. And you could just plant those outside when the weather is right. But I like to do plants because I can get a little start on things. So, yes. Give it a try.
Okay. I'm going to be in training on air from Lana Noctegal on seed growing. And you can turn too.
Good. I've got a book to talk about here. It's called The New Seed Starter's Handbook by Nancy Bubel, B-U-B-E-L. And that's kind of my well-thumbed advice for seed starters. We'll talk more about seeds and gardening next.
Tis coming.
Next week. We've barely scratched the surface or scarified the surface here. So, who was that nasty person that thought of dyeing beer green for St. Patrick's Day? I always thought it was horrible. Ruin a good beer by putting green stuff in it. But it is a tradition, and that does happen.
I had a good drink the other night. What? You mixed half champagne with half Guinness. It's called Black Velvet or something.
Oh, my.
That was our beginning St. Patrick's Day celebration. It was delicious.
Good. So, and there's new breweries in central Iowa here. Speaking of beer, I wonder if they're going to dye anything green. Oh, dear. Torrance Brewery is open here in Ames, and there's a new brewery going in as part of the Prairie Moon Winery north of Ames. And, of course, there's also a lot of old tried and true bars and restaurants and breweries in town that are probably going to be having some Guinness.
Rowdy tonight,
yeah.
I believe.
So,
I believe probably,
that'd be very nice.
Probably the London Underground. And what's the other British pub?
Oh, the Mucky Duck. Go and have something very...
Yeah, those
Mucky.
Two places will probably be lively tonight.
I bet they'd have some good beer. We'll go out with some more music from Bohola. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Noctegal.
And Donna Prisgintas.
With engineering by Rick. Music by Bohola. Plant a seed, enjoy a beer, and give a thought to the future of food. Eat good food and enjoy life.